You're listening to the Prestige 70 Podcast, a collection of intimate conversations with contemporary jazz artists with an eye toward the genre-defining music made on Prestige Records.
Our guest today is the son of a trumpeter in a Dixieland band, a virtuosic keyboardist revered as one of the principal forces in the fusion of jazz, rock, funk, and Latin music. He followed Herbie Hancock as pianist in Miles Davis's band, the band that recorded classics such as Bitches Brew. His restless creative spirit has seen him collaborate with vibraphonist Gary Burton and banjoist Bela Fleck, among many others. His numerous band projects include the groundbreaking Return to Forever, the acoustic band, the Chick Corea Trio, Trilogy. He's run 22 Grammy Awards and just recently nominated for his 23rd for the album Antidote. He's also been recognized as a National Endowment for the Arts Jazz Master. Chick Corea, welcome to the Prestige 70 Podcast.
Oh, thanks, Scott. Glad to be here.
We're thrilled to have you. I mentioned your father in the introduction. He was a trumpeter.
That's right.
Tell me about the music you heard him playing when you were a kid.
It was a great environment. We had this three-room apartment. It was on like a main street in Chelsea, Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. It was a bar room across the street and a grocery store downstairs. And my dad had a phonograph, in there mm-hmm. with speakers. And he had just a huge collection of 78 RPM. The ones that I remember were the Dial recordings. Dial Records, the yellow label, and the Charlie Parker recorded for. And Charlie Parker and Miles, when Miles was a young trumpeter, 17, 18 years old, playing with Bird, he had those recordings. He had the Billy Eckstein Big Band. He had Sarah Vaughan was working, was singing with Billy Eckstein then. And then as the years went on, the LPs came in but it was all jazz. That was what my dad was passionate about, and that's what the kind of music that he brought into his dance band, and that's what I listened to, and I loved it right away.
Was there, even at a young age, but you know, as you're going through elementary school and junior high school, was there an artist who caught your ear such that you knew that's something I want to pursue?
Well, all of it did, really. Like the way Charlie Parker played, I wanted to be able to play like that. And then when I heard Bud Powell playing with him, I wanted to play like Bud Powell. Then I heard Thelonious Monk, and I thought I wanted to play like that. And then when I heard Horace Silver later on, not only did I want to play like that, but I wanted to compose like that. And Horace was kind of my inroad into composition, because I was old enough to start to transcribe his solos and his compositions. Early on, like at the age of four, I would listen to Bud and want to play like Bud, but I could hardly, I was just beginning.
Probably could hardly reach the keys at that, at that point. Yeah. So you were playing piano at four, you were playing drums at the age of eight. If I understand correctly.
Yeah, the drums didn't come, actually, let's see. I didn't have drums in that first apartment. When I was 11, we moved to Everett, Mass. Mm-hmm. And when my mom made enough money to buy this little tiny house.
Yeah.
And that's where I got my first drum set. So I guess I was 11 or 12.
Yeah. You've later referenced the drums as being important to your piano playing.
Very, very important. They're the most fun instrument to play. They're as fun to play as the piano, actually. But in fact, when I first got to New York, it was like 1960. I got there in 59, and 1962 or so, 62 and 3. I was trying to make a living playing gigs on the piano, and when I would get a job on the piano. The other guys would come to the gig with their horns, all beautifully sounding beautiful, and then I would have to play on these out of tune, really badly bad pianos, and I would get embarrassed. It would get time for a piano solo, and I'd sound terrible. So I thought, this isn't working, and at that point I got my drum set. I rented a small room in a loft, and I practiced my head off, and I started working as a drummer for about a year and a half. until I got a call to work with Stan Getz, and I started working on nice big pianos.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Tell me about, I want to circle back on that stuff, but tell me about Salvatore Sulo. Who was Salvatore Sulo?
Sulo was a friend of the family. He was a wonderful classical pianist, an Italian guy who was in and amongst the Italians that my dad and mom and family were growing up with. And evidently he was a prodigy. He was born in the United States, but he got sent to Italy as a punishment because he was an unruly kid. So they sent him to a music school and he became a classical pianist, came back home, and he used to play concertos, piano concertos with the Boston Pops and so forth. So my dad, when I was 8 years old, said, well, you got to go to a real piano teacher now, because my dad was a trumpeter and he wanted me to learn from a pianist. So I went to Sulo, and Sulo really, he was good. He was funny. He didn't like jazz that much. He kind of made fun of it. But he took me under his wing as sort of one of the family and introduced me to Chopin and Bach and Beethoven.
But you, in later years, you have gravitated back to classical music in many ways.
Well, yeah, I mean, I have an interesting relationship to classical music because at first it was the pianisticness of it intrigued me. Mm. At Sulo's lessons, I would go and he would give me these pieces by Bach and Chopin and so forth. After high school, 1959, I got accepted to Columbia University. So I went to New York and tried going to school there, and it just didn't work. I ended up going down to Birdland and seeing Miles Davis play live. I mean, after you see Miles Davis and John Coltrane on the stage with Philly Joe Jones and Paul Chambers and Wynton Kelly on piano, you know, why do I want to study the history of Western civilization?
So. Tell me a little bit about that experience and what it meant to you in terms of your thinking.
Well, first of all, it's one of those kind of pleasure moments, and like everything about the experience is totally etched. I mean, if I could run the film of the memory for you, you'd really enjoy it. you know, and you'd have to see the film through a cracked glass in my right lens. I was wearing a pair of glasses that had cracked lens. I had to tape the lens, and you know. And I was on my own, and I walked downstairs at the old Birdland on 52nd Street and Broadway. At tables, there was a cover charge.
Yeah.
And I was alone. I didn't drink. So I was off in this part that just had chairs behind a railing called the bleachers. And that's where people like me sat who just wanted to listen. So I was right on the edge. And the way it dramatically rolled out was Paul Chambers walked out on stage with his bass, and Philly Joe came out and sat behind the drums. And they both, in my mind then, they both kind of sat there for quite a while. And Paul's holding his bass and kind of hanging there. And Philly Joe Jones had his sticks. And it seemed like a long time before the next thing happened, which is then Coltrane walked out on the stage and stood on the stage with his arms resting on his tenor saxophone, kind of just waiting. And then Wynton Kelly walked out wearing a hat, got a drink in one hand and a cigarette in the other hand, and he came across and sat at the piano. And, you know, the excitement is building. These are my heroes, every one of them. And then there was a little bit of time where Miles took the dramatic moment and he came to the front and he really took his time. He took his time. He didn't talk to the audience, but he took his time. He was there comfortably. He bent down. He put the Harmon mute in his horn. He put it in, got set. Everyone was ready. And then he put the Harmon mute on the microphone, which is what he used to do to get that sound. Like he put it literally right on the microphone, and he played, boo-doo-boo-beep, jing-jing, boo-doo-boo-beep. And they went into Autumn Leaves, and that was it for me. I mean, that was it. I mean, I went back to Columbia. I immediately made a call to my mom and dad, and I said, look, Mom, this is the university's not for me.
You had seen your direction.
You had seen your direction. Before then. It was just, it took me a little way around, you know.
So years later, obviously you come to play with Miles Davis. And I'm wondering if you recounted that story to him.
I was too humbled and shy to be just chatting with Miles at that point and telling him about when I first saw him like a fan. I was trying to find out how to be with Miles Davis. Mm.
You followed, you know, this just incredible, almost procession of pianists who played with him, you know, over time. You mentioned Wynton Kelly, and there's Red Garland, and there's Herbie Hancock, and
Bill Evans.
Mm-hmm. It's quite a list. I'm wondering for you, based on that history, talking about, you know, trying to figure out how to be, did you get any advice about playing with Miles? Did Herbie talk to you at all about the chair?
No, not a word. And you know, I gotta tell you and the public to listen that this is one of the old wives' tales and myths about the passing of the hat, especially in the jazz music that I grew up in, with the people that I grew up in. This is not something I came across. It was all done very casually. Tony Williams, who was a fellow Bostonian that I knew before he went to New York as a very young man. I knew Tony and played with him a little bit in Boston. Tony was the one that called me on the phone and said, "Hey, Miles wants you to come and play with him at this club in Baltimore if Herbie can't make it." That's all I heard. I said, "Can I call Miles?" So he gave me Miles' number, and I called Miles up and I asked Miles. I said, "I'm going to come play with you in Baltimore." He said, "Yeah." And I said, "Well, is there going to be rehearsal?" So, you know, he said, "Just play what you hear." So I never even spoke to Herbie about it. So I arrived in Baltimore at this club in Baltimore to play with this band that was already 5 years in oiling, and they were on fire. The only new member that had already replaced Ron Carter was Dave Holland, was on bass. But Wayne was there playing saxophone, and Tony Williams was playing drums. And the music took off like that. And I keep thinking Miles' instruction to me is play what you hear. Because I didn't know the changes to some of these pieces that they were playing. But their approach to all of the pieces that we were playing at that time was very abstract. And I could hear that. So Miles said, "Just play what you hear." That was his instruction.
So that was almost freeing in a sense.
Very freeing, and because I was used to by that time playing free music and playing what I hear. I had already made a recording called "Is" that was all free playing. Mm. So I did that. It was a very exciting rocket ride. Seemed like the set lasted about 3 seconds, and then it was over. And I was sitting at the bar afterwards with a drink, kind of wondering what had just gone down. And Miles came up to the back of me and put his mouth in my ear and gave me a compliment, which I can't relay in public.
But that must have been incredibly validating.
I ended up walking on a cloud for the next week.
Yeah. I think you mentioned it at some point that his recording of Someday My Prince Will Come was particularly inspiring to you in some way.
Someday My Prince Will Come, and that particular track where Train came in the recording studio and kind of sat in on the piece. Mm-hmm. That's the way that story goes. Because Hamp Mobley is playing tenor in Miles's band at that time. Train had already left to form his own group. But Coltrane appeared at the studio, and Miles invited him in to play on that tune. And Train's presence on that tune and his solo on that tune are totally, totally classic. And very inspiring. So it's Train's presence as well as Miles's rendition of Someday My Prince Will Come made that a very, very special track for me.
As a band leader, what made him special?
With his bands, he didn't give his musicians any instructions particularly. As I described when I came on the band, zero instructions. And what he tried to do was elicit from them their own interpretation of the music and their own way of getting on that thin edge that he liked to be on, which is that edge of spontaneity, of improvisation, of like taking the moment and giving the rendition from that viewpoint and not particularly relying on cliches and what you've done and what the last rendition was. And he wanted his other musicians to be operating that way. So that's the vibe that he put out in the band. He would occasionally say something. I asked him a few questions through the years, and he would give me terse answers, which always turned out to be pretty spot on, actually. But that was, he treated his musicians with love and with total respect as equal artists. He wanted to work with artists.
Mm. Yeah, I was struck and looking at watching the film on the making of your most recent record, Antidote. And it struck me that you do the exact same thing, is that you spend as much time in that film talking about the musicians in your band than you do about the music or yourself, for that matter.
Well, if you look at it, the kind of music I play and that Miles played at and that I love to play is all about the musicians. And as a composer, these are the creative beings that I bring together to realize what I laid down. So I don't want them to become robots and just read the notes. I want them to take the concept, which the notes, the written notes are kind of a guide, like a script. Mm. Another thing Miles did, which is interesting, and I do the same thing, is when I present a part to one of my musicians and I hear what he's doing, I always let him know that he should change the part around to suit himself. If he needs to remove a few notes or add a few other notes, just to make sure that he's got that rendition and he makes it his own. Mm. So the notes are much less important than that musician's rendition.
Tell me a little bit about, to backtrack just a second, because you mentioned before we started, Art Tatum.
Yes.
Tell me why he's, I think you've referred to him as the man when it comes to...
It's hard to describe anything about musicians and why, but... What can I say about Art Tatum? He in his way, did what Miles did, which was he was just, first of all, a completely spontaneous, creative improviser. Although his style, and the style that you hear coming out is very different than, the Great Quintet or Bitches Brew or any of that stuff. You hear this piano music rolling out, Liza and all of the American Songbook the way he does. But if you hear him play a song twice, you'll hear two completely different songs because he played each song in a new unit of time every time he played. And of course his command of the instrument was just prodigious. It was ridiculously over the top. That's why I said before he's probably my favorite pianists of all time, yeah. and next to Glenn Gould. Mm.
One of the things you did, if I understand, kind of early on in New York, while you were playing with small groups and starting that part of your career, you would play with Thad Jones and Mel Lewis in their jazz orchestra, big band, you know, in effect. And I'm wondering how that experience either changed your thinking about the small group process or in some way expanded your thinking about the music you were making.
Well, there's always the importance in a band is the individuals are the creative ones. Like in that band, Thad Jones was the creator. He was the arranger, composer, kind of the spiritual head of the band. Between him and Mel, they put the whole thing together. But Thad was the musical and spiritual leader of that band. So I came and I was sitting, subbing in for Roland Hanna. And Thad treated me in a similar way that Miles did, actually, now that I think about it. I'll give you an incident. Like my first night on the band down at the Vanguard in New York, we're doing this chart. Now I'm having to read charts. So I've got my eyes focused on reading the changes, and I'm trying to see what to do with the piano part. Mm. Then it comes this next section, it says piano solo. So, okay, all right. So I kind of knew the tune. I was playing a piano. So I played once through the cycle. And then while I'm playing and I'm looking at the music, the bass and drums stop. And I'm all on my own. And I'm going, right? And so I keep playing. I look up to see what's happening. And Thad is standing there looking at me like this, going, meaning, go ahead, son. You got it. He stopped the rhythm section to make me play alone. So he was incredibly encouraging to me.
One of the things, I think you mentioned about that experience of playing in a big band is, you know, not to be playing when the horns are going full blast.
Well, you got to watch Duke and Count Basie to see how to play with a big band. And Count Basie especially, he just let the band have it.
Yeah.
And then when there was a space, you'd hear him bling. But to be pounding away while the band is playing makes no sense.
Yeah. Just going back to joining Miles' band, you were introduced to an instrument that you had not encountered before, the Fender Rhodes. And if I understand, Miles encouraged this.
He demanded it. On my way to the bandstand, on this one particular gig, I was following behind him. We were actually having to walk through the audience in this club up to the stage, and there was already a piano there that I had played the night before, and I was headed toward the piano, and he saw me headed toward the piano, and he turned around, and he pointed to the other side of the stage where there was this electric instrument, and he said, play that. That's all he said. Two words. Play that. And that's when I said, how do you turn this thing on?
If I understand, there was a learning curve playing the Rhodes.
Yeah, it was tough. It was tough because I didn't like it at first. And you know, it was deliberate. I didn't know how to operate it. It was the main thing. Mm. And how to get a sound out of it and how to tune it. I had to tune it myself. You know, there's a certain way you tune a Fender Rhodes with these little springs that you have to slide up and down on a metal tine, and then I had to figure out how to get a sound out of it because it's an electric instrument. It needed a speaker, and some of them had speakers, like the Suitcase Rhodes had a speaker built in. Some of them didn't have any speaker and it needed to go through an amplifier, and I knew nothing about amplifiers. So, but I learned pretty quick, and I started to like it pretty quick because it got me up to a volume level where I could compete with Tony.
That's convenient.
Yeah.
That's convenient. Did it offer compositional opportunities?
Later on it did. After I played with Miles, I started to, when I put, after Miles, I played for a year and a half with Dave Hall and Anthony Braxton and Barry Altschul in a band called The Circle. Mm. And we played free music. We played without, mostly without songs or scores. But then after that, I formed my own band, Return to Forever. And that's when I started to compose for the with the Fender Rhodes sound in mind. Yeah.
Perfect segue, because that's where I was going next, was Return to Forever. And that group had a remarkable arc. You know, it kind of started in one place and went to many other places with Al Di Meola and the whole idea of fusion and all of that. I'm wondering, when you first put it together, what was your intention?
Well, my intention was real simple, because when I was playing with the band Circle, I was missing a kind of a groove and a swing that got people involved in a groove like that. Right around that time, I was writing more music, but right around that time, I was invited to play for a week at a club called the Blue Something in Philadelphia, and it was Joe Henderson's septet. So I loved Joe, so I went to play with Joe, and there on stage in the band was Stanley Clarke, with an upright bass and three amplifiers behind him. And I brought my Fender Rhodes. So Stanley and I hooked up big time on that gig. And so Stanley was the first musician that I wanted to invite into playing with me in this new ensemble. And it kind of built from there. I was looking for, actually the first drummer was Horace Arnold, who plays drums with me on my second recording called Is, along with Jack DeJohnette. And Horace and Stanley did some trio gigs experimenting with this music. Then the next thing that happened was I wanted to put a vocal in the band. I wanted a vocalist. And Ayerto's wife, I had met Ayerto in playing with Bitches Brew. So Ayerto introduced me to Flora, his wife. And Flora came by a rehearsal that I had in my loft one time to rehearse these new songs. And she brought Ayerto with him. Hey, how you doing, Ayerto? And she was singing, and Horace was playing the drums. So when we got around to playing Some Time Ago, which was a samba rhythm, I said, Ayerto, could you demonstrate, like, he's a Brazilian, I mean, he is Mr. Samba. So I said, could you demonstrate a rhythm for this piece for Horace, so Horace can see how the samba is played on a drum kit? Well, as soon as we started playing, him and Stanley and me, it was like, that was it. So over the next series of gigs with Horace, Ayerto would sit in on that one song, and then Horace would play the rest of the set. Eventually, Ayerto became the drummer in the band, and Flora was the vocalist. And then needing a flute and a saxophone. Well, actually, the first flute player in the band was Hubert Laws.
That's pretty good.
So that was a pretty killing group, but I needed a saxophonist as well, and I couldn't have two guys. So I found Joe Farrell, who was also a mentor for me in New York. He's a little older than me. He used to show me around. He came and really filled the bill, because he's a great flute player and he's a great saxophonist. So that became the first quintet.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
How did finding those musicians, particularly, you know, starting a band, how did it affect you in terms of the compositions you were writing? Did it take time to get to know kind of what the strength of that group would be?
You know, after one rehearsal and one night of playing, it became obvious to me what their strengths were. So it became very, very easy to write music for that quintet. It had sounds and textures in it that I was, first of all, Stanley's breadth of bass sounds and bass playing is magnificent with the acoustic bass, his ability to bow, his ability to play whatever on the acoustic bass. And then we began to introduce the electric bass as well in the first band. And then Joe with flute. I heard the sound with Fender Rhodes and flute playing unisons that became one of the sounds of the band that I really love. But then Joe on soprano and sometimes on tenor. And actually when we went in the studio, he could also play oboe and bass clarinet and other wind instruments to give me as a composer a breadth of timbres. Mm. And then Flora had a beautiful way to interpret the music with her vocals. So I had like a little orchestra there as a quintet.
One of the things that in reading about Miles, the interplay, the feedback from the audience, it seemed as though he considered the audience, you know, part of what was going on stage. You know, whatever energy the musicians were getting from the audience was important to him. Is that your sense of things?
Well, I mean, it's even more than that, which is without an audience, there's no music, really. I mean, not really. I mean, what's the purpose of it? I mean, I guess you could play for yourself forever. It's a pretty lonely life. But music and art is to be shared. To me, it's a social activity, music and art. Mm. The audience is either there in a performance or they're envisioned as to be there as a composer. It's an interaction. It's a performance. I like to use this word, big word. It's archetypical. Because if you think back to the very beginnings of humankind, what did we do with one another? Is entertain one another? I mean, on the aesthetic side of things, aside from the clubs and inventing fire and all of that,
and invading countries.
From all that stuff. Yeah. What is basic is that we communicate to one another, and when you communicate on an aesthetic level, you tell a story, or you make music, or you dance, or you sing. This is native sense to every human being. So the audience is always part of music.
You've had too many to mention collaborations with all manner of terrific artists. There were two that I want to talk to you about, and I mentioned them in the open. One is Gary Burton. When did you first meet him?
70, actually probably a little bit before 70, but we started playing together in 70 or 71. But I joined Stan Getz's band in 1967 and kind of replaced Gary. Gary went off to form his own group, and I got the gig with Stan. And actually I worked in one of Gary's first bands as a pianist, but that wasn't a right fit for either of us. But later on in 71, when we got together as a duet, it clicked really, really big time.
What did you hear in his playing? Why did it click big time?
You know, let me take this opportunity to say that it's always the musician, not the instrument. Always. It wasn't the vibraphone particularly. It was Gary and the communication that occurred when we played. I mean, then there's the sound of, okay, there's a vibes and a piano, but what goes on and how it interacts and how we create together, that was the whole thing. And there was this just immediately when we played together, it was easy, it was fun, it was kind of brisk, sometimes slow, but mostly brisk we played. And eventually, as we played together more and more, he showed his great admiration for my composing. Hmm. So I found the duet not only great to play with him pianistically, but also as a composer and arranger, it was a challenge to bring things to the duet that made us sound good, or that Gary liked to play. So, but he's Gary is one of the brilliant improvisers. I mean, he's playing this instrument, if you think about it, similar to a piano, which is it's a fixed metal bar that you bang on, mm-hmm. bong, like a bell, bong, and to make that, to get romance out of that and lyricism out of that is just like it's a kind of a trick. Mm. It's a miracle.
And nuance.
Yeah.
I mean, it isn't just banging on
exactly
something.
Yes.
I'm imagining some of what you just said also applies to Béla Fleck.
Without a doubt. I had no particularly liking of the banjo.
In a vacuum.
I do now, by the way, having worked with Béla sure. a lot now. He's really educated me on the instrument and its history. But prior to that, I had not a lot of experience with the banjo. It was a ping, ping, pong, ping, ping, pong, pong. It was sounded kind of funny to me, you know. But again, it was working with the man himself mm-hmm. and the interaction that we got into. And then it became the musical sonic possibilities of putting the piano together with the banjo sound, which we're still working on.
Yeah, because I'm not sure you would someone would necessarily just gravitate to, oh yeah, piano and banjo.
Piano and banjo, right.
Yeah.
It's not a natural duet, that's for sure. Yeah.
How were you introduced to him?
Béla, my remembrance, Béla has some other things that he remembers, but my remembrance is meeting him at the Grammys, actually. He was nominated for a Grammy the same year I was. This was a long time ago. And he introduced himself, and I met him that way. And then he invited me to play with him and on a recording, which was a blast. And so then I would begin to invite him to sit in with me until we finally decided, well, let's do a project together.
Yeah. Did you collaborate in terms of writing compositions?
You know, the way we did that for our first recording was, I think it worked very, very well, which is he wrote some stuff and I wrote some stuff. And I'd send him the music as a PDF, and he'd look at it, and I'd try and make a little demo, and he'd do the same for me. We ended up having his compositions and my compositions, but we didn't actually collaborate as composers. I was never, I mean, as an improviser, that's where the collaboration happens if you're going to improvise something with another. Mm. When we improvise together, we kind of co-create or compose as we go along. But as far as writing a song or writing a form down, I've never found it a way to do that with another. It's always been on my own. Mm.
That's interesting, actually, because, you know, there's a whole world out there of, you know, collaboration and co-writing and, you know, people who write together, but you find it...
But, you know, that's a misnomer. In a sense. It's a misnomer because if two people are creating something, the way it really works is one person creates something and shows it to the other person. Then the other person takes that and he takes something and he creates something else of it, and it goes back and forth like that, I guess. But two minds don't have a thought. Hmm. Only a single mind has a thought. Then the thought is transmitted, and then the other mind then goes, has an opinion about it.
Or changes it in
changes
some way.
It or sends something right. back or whatever.
Yeah. A couple years ago, for your 75th birthday, you did a series of performances in New York with seemingly almost every...
8 weeks.
8 weeks. So almost every configuration or band that you, or artist that you had worked with?
Well, not every. Yeah. But a little hyperbole. Many.
But some
new ones, too.
Yes. And certainly reflective of, you know, the arc of your career. And I'm wondering, at the end of all of that,
I needed a vacation.
Yeah, well, I'm sure. I'm sure. What did you learn about yourself in that process?
I learned that I needed a vacation after 8 weeks of working hard.
Yeah.
But I also learned I relearned that when I have myself surrounded by friends and such artistry that of these musicians that came to play with me, it's like riding on a cloud. I mean, my biggest job during those 8 weeks was as a librarian, because I needed to put sets together of saying, well, let's play this, and the other guys may have needed some music beforehand, and so I had to go through my files and be sending music out. That was 95% of the job as a librarian. But once I got to the gig to play, it was just with these great people.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that I think marks your career is a willingness to change, a willingness to explore, and this desire to push forward. And I think you've talked about that impulse to create. Can you describe that for us? What is that impulse in you?
It's the same as in you and in all of us. It's the same impulse. It's buried in most, but when it's nurtured and when it's allowed to flower, great things can happen. I mean, that's what a person does, is he creates. Otherwise, you become a leaf drifting in the wind. I mean, you know, moved around by everybody else and everything else. So to create is to have something that you'd like to do and to do it, and more and more. And then there are different wavelengths that you can create on. You can explode a bomb, or you can write a song. I chose to write songs and to play songs. So, through life, as I continually notice that this thing of creating music and sharing it with audiences and people and other musicians, it stimulates the same wavelength in them. Like, you know, you play music for someone, they have to go up to that wavelength to receive it, right? So they receive it. So now we're on that wavelength. I've even taken to tuning audiences up to an A440 just to get on that wavelength, you know. And it's the joy of living. It's if there had to be a reason for existence, it would be the reason for existence. It would be creating and sharing it with one another on an aesthetic level. What better game could there be? And then, as I see that people would benefit by it some way, even if it's just a little bit of pleasure, or sometimes inspiring, or sometimes more, or whatever. I felt that I was contributing something to my environment, and so I just keep doing it. You know, you win a Grammy, what am I going to do with that aside from take it as an encouragement to just do more? Like, oh, I'm being acknowledged for that creation, so I better keep going, man.
And many artists I've talked to take it that way.
Yeah, it's a natural impulse.
You know, as an encouragement to, okay, now I have to go do more of this. You know, we've been talking about jazz, and we've been talking about classical music, you know, a little bit. Do you think the idea of genre is limiting?
It's a total. I've got to think of a much stronger word than limiting. It's a total barrier to creation. Genre, or thinking in terms of styles, because all genres and all styles are generalities. They're fine for the language. If you have to say, I'm going to a jazz concert or a classical concert, It's in chatting. But if you're trying to study a subject, if you're trying to really learn something about a craft or an art form, the genres can be red herrings. They'll just lead you all over the place. You see, because when you say, like, if I ask a guy, what kind of music do you like? Yeah, I like jazz. What does that even mean? What do you mean you like jazz? Oh, you mean you like the way Paul Whiteman plays? Or another guy will go, oh, I like the way, I like George Gershwin's music. Oh, I see. Oh, another guy will go, I like the way Eric Dolphy plays. Oh, I see. Another guy will go, I like the way Kenny G plays. Oh, I see. Now you get an idea of what he's talking about, because he's speaking about specific artists. But he says, I like jazz. What does that even mean?
I spoke to, had a conversation with a young, for the purpose of this conversation, a young pop artist, who said to me, genre was devised as a means to sell music. It doesn't affect me, speaking of herself.
Yeah, it's a marketing term.
At all.
I agree. I mean, there's nothing wrong with marketing either. It's not like it's bad. You got to market something in order to sell it. But it's, it's the way the world works.
Yeah.
But to create, you don't need, genres don't matter much.
Obviously, we're doing this as part of the Prestige 70 celebration. And I'm wondering, because you may have crossed paths, did you ever cross paths with Bob Weinstock, the gentleman who founded Prestige?
I don't think I ever met Bob, no.
Yeah. He had, obviously, a very, very unique approach, particularly early on in terms of putting musicians together. There was not a lot of rehearsal, he put people in a room and let them do, what great musicians do.
It's what a good producer does, is he finds the artists and puts them in the room and lets them do his thing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of the conversations I read that Miles had with him when he brought Miles back to New York from East St. Louis was the goal was to just find the best musicians he could and put Miles in the room with them and see what happened. And that's where you get these incredible, half a dozen or whatever albums on Prestige with those remarkable names, Relaxin', Cookin', Steamin'.
Right.
It's an incredible body of work.
Right, right. Well, I mean, I don't have hard specific data on this, but knowing how those bands probably got put together, they weren't put together by a producer. That's for damn sure. Miles put those bands together. I don't think the producer had anything to do with choosing John Coltrane or Philly Joe Jones or, completely Miles's thing. But to give Miles the platform to make that music. By the way, those recordings, I don't know if you know this about Prestige, but the story that I got was all of those working, steaming, relaxing albums that were done as the completion of a contract.
Yes.
And they were done in just a few days.
Yes.
Right.
They were done like in two sessions, I believe, two or three.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And because they were obviously, all of them were, I'm pretty sure they were all first takes, pretty well first takes, because they, even time-wise, to get all of those tracks in, they would have to be throwing them down one after the other. But those were that was the set list that Miles was playing in clubs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, and that is absolutely the case.
Yeah.
He had already signed to Columbia.
Right.
And he needed to complete his contract.
Right, right.
To Prestige. So last question. I mentioned in the open 22 Grammy Awards, nominated now for your 23rd. And we talked briefly about the Grammy Award being kind of an encouragement or motivation to do more. But as you look back at this kind of recognition, what does it mean to you?
It's just I don't know how to say it. It's just I hope I'm not getting in the way of other people winning Grammys. you know, first of all, you know, in all deference to all of the very, very good works that the Grammy organization does in education and in getting the laws to change in the favor of musicians and composers and artists and so forth, I'm with all of that. I'm definitely happy to be a member of NARAS for so long. But it must be said at one point that a competition is not part of the basic nature of an artist. Mm. And that's why you see this kind of response when you ask me or others, like, what does it mean to win Grammys? Because you're not out there to win something. You're out there to be with the other artists as this tacit, and sometimes not so tacit, mission that we've got to just uplift spirits and just bring the music to the world. Mm. So everything that the Grammys do to accomplish that goal, and maybe a competition is the thing that makes people look into the show, you know, who's going to win, you know, like a football game.
Yeah.
But in actual fact, there's, in my mind, art and music is such a subjective thing that all it can be is a popularity voting thing. So I thank all of those who vote, of course, because they're voting for me. Wow, mm-hmm. Gee, thanks. But I'm humbled by it. Yeah. But I just have to go out and write my next piece of music.
Mm-hmm. You know, I lied. I've one additional question, because you mentioned uplifting spirits and your latest album, Antidote. That's very much the intention here.
Oh, without a doubt. We're the antidote. That's the whole idea of antidote. Mm. That's how the lyric came about. We dance and we sing and we play, and we don't particularly like war and cruelty. Mm. excuse me. That's what the artists are all about. So you could say in a humorous way that we're kind of an antidote. We come to town and boom, have some of this. Go to another town. Look, take some of this. Get them dancing and singing, and get them on that wavelength. And because if you read the newspapers or the media, all you get is bad news. It's not true, by the way, that it's all bad news. But that's what you get inundated with. And there are, you know, it's not a completely peaceful planet. so we're the antidote.
Yeah. Well. We very much enjoy the fact that you are the antidote in your music. We could not be more grateful that you took the time to join us. Chick Corea, thank you so much.
Well, thanks for your interest, man. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Great.
Okay.
You'll find additional episodes of the Prestige 70 podcast at craftrecordings.com/Prestige70 or wherever you download podcasts. This episode was brought to you by Craft Recordings, crafting the future from the past. Edited by Zach Stilwell and produced by Laura Saez, I'm Scott Goldman. Thanks for listening.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.